Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Guy Pratt.
And I'm Gary Kemp, and we're getting ready for the next Rock on Tours Live.
Join us at the iconic Battersea Power Station in London for a special screening of Quadrophenia, greatest youth cult movie ever made, followed by a recording of the podcast where our guests will be director Frank Rodham and the star, Phil Daniels.
Yep, it's happening on February the 22nd. Tickets are now on sale. Go to thecinemainthepowerstation.com.
A celebration of British classic Quadrophenia.
See you then.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you and Merry Christmas to all of our listeners.
Yes, all of you. What are you up to tomorrow?
Nothing.
I haven't bought you a present, you know that. Bought you nothing.
You never do. You never do, Gal. You never get me a present. No, I'll be doing, I don't know, something vaguely Christmassy. I like doing things on other days around, do you know what I mean? But it's different for you, Gal. You've still got children at home.
We folk. I love the build-up to Christmas. I really do. I love that sort of, you know, the vibe. And I have felt Christmassy. I think, you know, I had a little party at my house and that got me in a Christmassy mood. That was the gateway, really, for me. It's like a gate.
It's very much your Christmas party is very much a gateway joke, and I must say what an amazing party it was. We now realise that the real reason that we've been doing Rock on Tours for the last few years is so that Gary can harvest celebrities for his Christmas party.
But we had a few celebrities that we would love to have on. They were there, and we still can't twist their arm, can we?
That's right. Yeah, we tried that. But, yeah, again, this is the other reason for you throwing your party is in the hope of luring people onto Rock on Tours.
Of course, Rock on Tours is the centre of my existence, as it should be. It should be. And our guest today. I mean, there's none more Christmas, really, is there?
None more Christmassy. Well, there's only one or two who would be equally Christmassy, one of whom we've had, which, of course,
Noddy.
Is Noddy Holder. But nothing says Christmas special more than our guest.
Yeah, more than our guest.
I mean, what a fantastic history. I mean, three legendary bands, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, and 20 singles in the UK charts.
Come on, Bill, come on.
Three UK number ones. But, you know, when you... Oh, and of course, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with ELO in 2017.
That was nice, by the way. Don't you think that was nice, considering... I mean, because that's not... You know, that one album, which is brilliant, by the way, and I would recommend anyone go and listen to the first album, which is The Electric Light Orchestra. Yeah. But that's not what hit, you know. That's kind of not what got in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, is it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's great that he got in on
He got embraced in that by Jeff Lynne.
Yes.
Well, they were so important together. But of course, obviously, Jeff wasn't there when Roy started in The Move. And there's tons of such good music from The Move.
I mean, such good music. It's been a great rabbit hole. And really well produced. And well, it was that legendary duo of... you know, it was Danny Cordell, wasn't it?
That's right.
And Tony Secunda.
Tony Secunda.
But anyway.
That's easy for you to say, isn't it? And to stay safe.
I used to know his brother, actually, Danny Secunda. He used to run Track Records.
Do you know his wife, Chiquita, was the one who first put the glitter on Mark and David's face? Do you know that story?
So Chiquita Secunda.
Chiquita Secunda.
How dare you?
So they were at a party, and I think it was the night before that Mark was going to go on Top of the Pops for the first time. And she got some glitter from her makeup. She put it under his cheek and said, "Why don't you go on like this?" And of course, David saw that happening. He was at the party. He was at the other side of the room. And he came running over and he said, "Glitter me too," you know, sort of thing. And
glitter me too. That's brilliant. That's our new battle cry.
Yeah. I tell you, they'll shoot me first with my pantaloons. Anyway. Yeah, so yes, there's lots to talk about. There's The Move, there's Electric Light Orchestra. Oh, and he had a band called Wizard, right?
Who went on to do all sorts of other stuff as well. He produced lots of other people, did all sorts of other things. He's brilliant.
Yeah, big story.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock Haunters podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Greetings.
Yes, you're on the phone. Haven't got you at a bad time, have we?
What's talking to you lot?
Hello, mate.
Greetings.
Look at that. Hi, Roy. I'm Guy. Delighted to meet you.
Hello, Guy. Hi, Gary.
Hello, mate. Nice to have you on. Thanks for doing this. We bumped into each other, didn't we, in the Peak District.
Yeah, in Derbyshire, yeah. What a shock. It's one of those because I'd never met you before. And I looked across and I just said hello. I know him. And then you came over and introduced yourself, and that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
If it was in London, I'd have known you straight away, but being up there, I didn't, you know.
Exactly.
It's like somebody not wearing the uniform, you know what I mean?
So what, were you both out walking or something?
No, we were in a hotel in the Peak District.
Gary might have been, I wasn't, definitely.
Yeah. I think you were getting dropped off by a car and I saw you, and then I went over and I had a chat with you at your table. And
yeah, it was great.
And I thought, you know what, we've got to get you on Rock Haunters. So here we
great,
are.
Great.
Yeah, I love your medieval Crusader stained glass windows. Did you put those in?
Thanks. Yeah, I thought I'd turn the desk around a bit to make it a bit more interesting. Well, the bookshelves are at the other end of the room. They're usually at the back of you.
And is that the shovel guitar, the spade guitar?
Oh, yeah.
Eagle eye. Eagle eye.
For those of you listening on radio... I'm just showing them the spade guitar.
Look at that. Fantastic.
So it's a guitar that looks like a spade. What made you think of that?
Well, I did a drawing of a Spear and Jackson shovel and put some...
Sorry, say that again.
put some tuning pegs and pickups on it. And I thought, well, that looks great. So I gave it to John Birch and he made it. Here's another one, Wally, there. I'm just changing the strings on it.
It's a double neck.
Hang on a minute. It's a double neck Fender Strat.
I've never seen one of those. Wow.
And it's a guitar at the top and a six-string bass at the bottom.
Wow.
Fantastic. So, and has it got an ice maker in the back? David Gilmour's got a double neck Strat, or he had it, because he had this piece. He said somehow he ended up with this piece of mahogany. And he just had it hanging around, didn't know what to do with it. So he thought, actually, why don't I get a double neck Strat? So he had a double neck Strat made, and he put it on. So it was so heavy.
Yeah.
It looks like, when I look at it, though, it makes me feel like it needs to go in for a 16-hour operation in a German hospital or something. be separated.
A bit like myself.
But with was the spade guitar at the same time as the Yob guitar? Was that a 70s thing?
Yeah, it was, yeah. John Birch used to make a lot of guitars.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
He was a bit of a lad, though, John Birch, because I only found out later. Because, like, in those days, he didn't take much notice of your guitars and that. I mean, I the one that I had... that my parents bought me, which was originally Flamingo Pink, I think it was called. And it sprayed all sorts of colours because it was a thing to do in those days.
Yeah.
And I really wish I hadn't. And what Bertie used to do is, I didn't realise till later that he used to, for your listeners, there's a place on the back of a Fender guitar with a serial number on it, which denotes what year it was made and all this
stuff. The neck plate, yeah.
The neck plate, yeah. So what he used to do is he used to nick the neck plates and put them on his own guitars and flog them for loads of money.
Oh, my God.
And yet I ended up with a neck plate on the back of mine that was no number at all. Wow. And I didn't even realise.
So there are guitars out there that proper dealers are probably selling for the wrong price.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it's with guitar, because with basses, if it's got an L in front of it, that's when it gets really valuable, because that's pre-CBS.
Yeah.
Sorry, you started.
I didn't know that.
Basses.
I will now.
So there's so much
you're
to
go
talk
just,
to you
just
about.
Just chisel L's into the back number.
Right. There's so much to talk to you about, Roy. I mean, listening back to... I mean, my God, man, look at you. I'm looking at you here now, and you look fantastic. Yeah. And I can't believe you go back to the 60s.
You don't look so bad yourself.
You go back to the 60s, to psychedelia. And, I mean, listening to those early Move songs in the last couple of days.
It's such a great rabbit hole.
Genius. And for anyone to come up with the title, I Can Hear the Grass Grow. I mean, what a great title that was.
Thanks.
But all of it, going back to Night of Fear, your first one, which I noticed has a bit of Tchaikovsky in there. So you were really ahead of that game that we all thought was invented with ELO.
Sure. I mean, I always wanted to do that. And it was only later that I was in a position to do the ELO thing. But I'd always been influenced by orchestral stuff because my parents always played it at home, you know.
Because you're self-taught, right?
Yeah.
But you're self-taught on everything. Like cello and stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
saxophone.
I've never had any music lessons.
Amazing.
So what was the house like where you grew up in? Was it with your parents musical?
Well, my mum played the piano and my sister did. There was a piano in the house, but in fact, I played quite a lot of instruments, but I never had the, unlike you lot, I didn't have the patience for piano and I'm not very good on it. I mean, I'm all right, I play a few chords if I want to write something. But if somebody said, can you play a tune? Give us a tune. And I couldn't do it, you know.
Yeah. So you haven't got the patience for the piano, but you got the patience for the cello. Okay.
Yeah, cello and the bagpipes, yeah. That's a challenge.
So how did they come in? How did those instruments come into your life? What was the first instrument you owned?
We never really had any money, you know, the same as all of us when we first started and that. But when in the Move, when we started to earn a little bit, I started to collect instruments. And there were a couple of shops down the Stratford Road in Birmingham that sold secondhand ones. And I bought a string bass, which I loved, called it the Killer. And that was marvellous. And
after Jerry Lee.
Yeah. So what else did I buy? I bought an oboe, a tenor horn, a few things. And then I thought, it became a bit of a hobby, you know. I just started collecting them. Yeah. And you can't collect them without having a go on them, you know what I mean? And it came in useful later when I did my solo albums and I played all the instruments on the album because I'm not really very good at any of them, to be fair, but I'm good enough to play my own songs, if you know what I mean.
To blow your own trumpet.
I can choose and write some easy parts.
But was it rock? You're saying there was classical music in the house, but was it rock and roll that made you pick up an instrument? What was? Did you have that defining moment? That kind of?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean,
Beatles on the radio, Elvis or whatever.
First thing I ever played was drums at my sister's wedding when I was six. Because
I bet they loved that.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Had you been asked?
Yeah, well, my dad knew it. There's a bloke called Sam Harris who had a little band which actually played at the wedding. He used to play Tim Parley in the Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, and he was a nice guy, you know. And he taught me a little bit on the drums and for my sister's wedding. And I got up and did that. I did a little swing thing with a quartet or something. So that's the first time I ever played. And the next thing I think was my dad bought me a chromatic harmonica when I was 10, and I had a go at that. Guitar, yeah, when I was around about 12 or 13, I got on the bus, number 14 bus, into Birmingham, to Birmingham Town Hall to see the Shadows.
Oh, there it is.
It was just, because I've been a fan anyway, like buying a Cliff and the Shadows singles and all that. And I just love the sound of the guitar and that. And to listen to it live, it sounded like Hank's guitar had been dipped in Dettol, you know. It was so clean and lovely and dying and fabulous. And even Bruce Welch was playing a Fender Jazzmaster, which I'd never seen before. And you could hear all the strings going swing, you know, when he played across. Gorgeous. It was fabulous. Those of us who know, who've probably played Birmingham Town Hall since, it's terrible. The sound is rotten. And the secret was that the only way to get a good sound there was to play quiet, which the Shadows did. They played quietly just through Vox AC30s. And it sounded fantastic. So on Magma, Mom and Dad, forever after that, to buy me a guitar, which was like the first guitar I had was a Hofner Colorama. Because it had a Chevalo arm. None of wanted to do all those things.
Because also everyone had Hofners, didn't they? Because you couldn't buy American guitars in those days.
Well, professionals did, yeah. But that's a designer guitar to have.
Yeah. But, you know, it was still German makes were popular, weren't they?
Yeah. It was the closest you could get, wasn't it, to a Strat then in those days?
That's what George had, wasn't it? George had his first guitar his parents bought him was a Hofner President.
Yeah.
Is it true, though, that talking about the Shadows and Hank, because I did read somewhere that after Carl left the Move, Carl Wayne, that you asked Hank to play guitar for the Move. Is that true? Wow. What did he say?
He politely said, well, I'm doing all right, thanks, you know. I know. I'd always been a big fan. I didn't ask him, but I suggested it, you know. But he actually invited us round to the office. We went into his manager's office or something, and he came in and he was really nice and everything. And he said, "I think I've got it sorted. I don't really want to join another band."
But if he'd said yes, you wouldn't have asked Jeff Lynne. Do you think Jeff wouldn't have joined if Hank had said yes?
There's a point. Yeah,
the whole of rock and roll would have changed.
Yeah,
that's true.
Cool.
I've got to say, looking at this, Roy. One thing you've got to say about Birmingham in the mid-60s is all the bands had fantastic names.
Falcons,
Jerry Levine and the Avengers, Mike Sheridan and the Knight Riders, who later became the Idle Race. I mean, that really
that was a thing, Guy, wasn't it? In that early 60s, during the Parnes era, to name a band someone's name and the somethings, because for a while it was John Lennon and the Silver Beatles, wasn't
That's
it?
Right. Yeah,
they
were
trying yeah. When I thought of the name of the Move, I just called it Move, and I did the lettering on some plates and saucers on some paper, and gave it to a sign writer to do the logo and all that. And it was the promoters that changed it. They used to call it The Move or The Who, or I think even with your band. Pink Floyd, they called it The Pink Floyd, which is ridiculous. It sort of stuck. It stuck with us after that. But then, you know, saying about the name of the bands, you know, and all that, it was probably the only the name that was any good.
But also, what a scene that was with the Moody Blues up there as well.
Yeah, and Spencer Davis, and there was a few. Yeah, there's some good ones.
Were Band of Joy around then? No, or was that?
Say again.
Band of Joy, were they around then? Or was that a bit later?
Oh, Robbers.
Yeah.
But they sort of moved in different circles somehow, you know. He was more doing the bluesy clubs and that kind of thing, whereas we were doing things like the Plaza and all that, you know, just local ballroom kind of places.
Did the Move start as a sort of psychedelic band? Did that come out of your influence, Sgt. Pepper's, or was it to do with Moody Blues, you know, that big album that they made, Days of Future Past?
Oh, that was later.
But it wasn't influenced by the Moody Blues or any of that. I mean, we used to play, all of the Move used to play in separate bands in Birmingham. And we used to congregate at a place called the Cedar Club, because in those days, that money was crap everywhere. And the only way you could make any money was to do what they called a double. So you'd go and play... You go and play first at the ice rink, and then do the double at the Cedar Club or another club. So you did two gigs in one night.
And that's hauling your amps around and everything.
Yeah. None of us had much of a life apart from that. So if we had a night off, we'd go down to Cedar Club anyway, even if we weren't playing, just to take the mick out of the bands that were on, kind of thing, you know. And we got chatting about stuff, and we were all pretty fed up with being a human jukebox and just doing the chart stuff and that kind of thing, which we did. We all did Beatles covers and all that kind of stuff. And I'd already written some songs anyway. And at the time, I was with Mike Sheridan and the Knight Riders, who weren't really interested in any original songs at all at the time. And I did some demos on a home t- tape recorder and played them to a couple of people that were eventually in the move, and they said, yeah, let's do that, you know, let's be a bit more original. So that's how it all started.
But what was the influence in those songs, do you think? Where did you pitch yourself?
Ooh, now, good question. I don't know. I mean, it was just, I wish I could do that now. It was just whatever came out of my head when it went onto the paper and I sang it. But I wish I could do that now and not be influenced by a fashion, you know, which over the years you do, don't you? You get influenced by other people and fashion. And in those days, there wasn't so much competition. It was just like rock and roll and melodies, really. I'd always been a person to like, I like good melodies so everybody can sing along, you know, and all that.
But your songs have always been, from those early Move ones, have been like really, really well constructed and like lots of chords and stuff. They're actually technically very correct.
Thank you. I'm glad you said that. I wanted to make my songs singable, but not three chord structures. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make them so that it was interesting for the musician to play, like me. I don't like playing three chord things. And so I made, if there was only three chords in it, I'd throw a load more in just to make it more interesting for myself.
But also lyrically, you know, there was a sense of Britishness and sort of whimsy that's in there as well, and storytelling that you were, you know, you weren't singing about, you know, that's the old American rock and roll, you know, falling in love with my baby.
Cars and girls.
People have said before, you know, what were your songs influenced by? And I mean, what did you do? That kind of thing. I've never written songs about personal strife or any of that, right, which is like rubbish. All my songs have just been stories that I've made up. And I started doing that before I was like playing. And now, when I was at art school, I wrote some stories.
So, Roy, how did the Move begin then? Because you were in this other band, and then, so what was, how did it you form, and who was it?
Well, we used to meet up occasionally at the Cedar Club and have a chat about stuff. And then the chats became more intense. And we thought, well, we're all fed up with what we're doing. Why don't we get a band together? So, yeah, it was me. I was from Mike Sheridan and the Knight Riders. And then Carl Wayne sort of came into the picture. We wanted to be more Beatlesque and have instruments and voices.
Because you had four singers, didn't you?
If you can call it that, yeah. So Carl came in because basically Carl was very good at, I mean, he was a good singer, yeah, but he was very good at organising things, which none of the rest of us were, if you know what I mean. And he got meetings together and this, that and the other. So there's me and Carl and Ace Kefford on bass, Trevor Burton on guitar as well, and Bev Bevan on drums. We all just decided to do it, and we started with, I had four songs written on the like little tape recorder, and we started with those. And then obviously to get work locally, because we weren't known or any of that, we needed to do chart stuff. So we sort of zoomed in on sort of Motown-y things, you know, we were playing those. We were playing like a rock and roll band version of Motown songs.
Which is kind of where rock comes from, doesn't it? Apart from which was white guys playing soul music.
Yeah, it was a big influence on the Beatles.
Yes.
Yeah.
But also your Deep Purples and everyone. But, you know, that's kind of...
Yeah. Well, it was soul music and country music, wasn't it, originally, that it all came from, yeah. Yeah.
So who was managing you then?
Nobody. We just did it. There were local agents that used to book us. You know, it was one of those kind of things. In those days, the Belfry, which is like a golf centre, there used to be a gig there, which was a good gig, and we did the gig. And who turned up that night was a guy called Tony Secunda, who managed the Moody Blues. Yeah. And he came along. I didn't know about this, but someone asked him to come along and have a look at us. And then he thought we were really good, you know, and he wanted to take us to London and put us on the pavements, you know, of gold kind of thing.
Because we were talking earlier, Guy and I, Tony Secunda's wife was Chiquita
Secunda. And his brother was Danny Secunda, who ran Track Records. But go on, Gary, tell your story.
No, no, just that she, I'd heard, was the one who put glitter under Mark Boland's eyes and was also the night before he played Top of the Pops. When I started reading more about you, I actually think you're the person who invented glam, because you were the first person to paint a star on your forehead and throw your hair out.
I was the first. I think I was the first to do the makeup thing, which was before Bowie, in fact.
Yeah.
And this came about when we did a single called Brontosaurus with The Move, and Carl Wayne had just left as lead singer, so everybody pointed to me to do it, and someone I knew made me a long sort of coat with triangles on, the black and white triangles, which was the Brontosaurus coat, which I wore on. We did Old Grey Whistle Test. We did that. And I wore that coat on it, and everybody else went to the bar, and I thought, well, there's something missing there. I back comb my hair all out, and I managed to get some makeup, and I did triangles around my face like that, and a star in the middle of the forehead, and which matched the jacket that I was wearing, the coat. It was a long coat, and I thought, oh, that'll do. And we went on and did that, and then that's the first time I used that kind of thing. But then when I started Wizard, I thought, well, it's a shame to lose that, really. Let's have a multicolored version of that, which is that was the Wizard image then.
Yeah, no. I mean, because that was definitely the first time anyone had ever done anything like that, I'm sure. And is it on Old Grey? Is it on YouTube that Old Grey was obsessed?
It should be. Yeah, I remember seeing it. I heard an interview by. This is great. I heard an interview by John Lennon, who said he was talking about different British bands and everything, and he was on about seeing that thing on the Old Grey Whistle Test, and he phoned a couple of mates and said, "You've got to watch this."
Wow.
Because I was obviously that one. I think I'm not sure if we mind it or not, but it was easy to do. So I ended up rolling around the floor with my guitar and that, biting the heads off whippets and stuff, you know.
Wow.
And sort of Leonard got on the
Hendrix
phone to
stroke Iggy Pop.
Yeah, Leonard got on the phone to his mate and said, "You've got to watch this."
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Because you first went in the studio with Glyn Johns, didn't you, before it was Denny Cordell?
Well, Denny Cordell was our first producer. So
it was the first producer, right.
Of it, yeah. But in those days, a lot of producers used to rely mainly on the recording engineer, you know, to do all the work, in fact, and then just put their name on the label. And unfortunately, I think Denny was one of those, you know.
Oh.
And but I took this into my brain, and every time we did a session, I was really making sure I could see what the engineer was doing, so it all went in there, and I could use it later on, you know.
Ah.
Was Glyn Johns part? Did Glyn Johns ever work with you?
Yeah, he did. Glyn Johns did work with the Move.
I think he did on a couple. Yeah.
Also, because I've just been rereading, just coincidentally, the other day I was rereading My White Bicycle, the Joe Boyd
book. Oh, it's a great book.
And he absolutely raves about the Move, about how he was desperately trying to get you signed to Elektra, and he thought you literally could have been like The Who in America.
I think mainly the failure of the Move in America was just bad management. We didn't get the breaks.
Talking of management, though, he was quite a wild manager, wasn't he, Tony Secunda? He got you to get up to all kinds of tricks. And I know at one point you got sued by Harold Wilson, but what else was he going? What other mad stuff was going on?
Oh, it was all mad. I mean, I tried to distance myself from all that, really, you know, as far as I could. Because all I wanted to do, I mean, the only reason I wanted to be in a band then is to get my songs heard by people, you know, simple as that.
Yeah.
And if I could have done just a studio thing like Brian Wilson and just written for the band and stayed up off the stage, I would have welcomed that, you know, I would have done it.
Your image and your persona doesn't say that.
No. But in saying
no,
that,
I'm just, he hides. I'm covering it all up with bullshit.
Exactly. Yeah. But Tony came up with some wacky ideas. I know that one of the things that I think probably upset Carl, I don't know, but you ended up being sued by Harold Wilson because he'd created some postcard of him and Marcia Williams in bed. What was?
I can publicise this now. Yeah, you have the scoop. It was a publicity postcard for Flowers in the Rain with the Move's name on, and it had a cartoon of Wilson with his secretary, which was libelous. And Secunda knew the right people. I knew nothing about it, full stop. There were people around that Secunda knew that actually posted the postcards in the right letterboxes. Anyway, the next thing we knew, we were summoned to the High Court and we were getting sued for it. And Secunda thought, oh, great, you know, bit more publicity. But what happened in the end, we arrived for the thing. They wouldn't allow us. I think Secunda must have done a deal with someone before that. And they wouldn't allow us in court to state our case because none of us really knew much about it. I knew absolutely nothing. I think Carl knew about it and he advised Secunda not to do it. And anyway, we ended up, we arrived at the Old Bailey. It was all on the front pages. So Secunda was going, yeah, great, and all this. So what it was, if I could have got in there and said my piece, I could have said, well, I knew absolutely nothing about it. But the result was they took away all our royalties and gave them to the Harold Wilson Trust. And I lost more than everybody else because I wrote the song. Oh. And they nicked Flowers in the Rain and the B-side. Oh. I've never earned a penny from any of it since. But now... Oh. Now that Marcia Williams has died, his secretary, I might stand a chance now because there are a few things coming out in the newspapers saying that Wilson did have an affair with her, you know, and yeah. The result from that was they were saying, well, he didn't, and now he has. Hopefully, I don't think I'm going to ever get the money back that I'm owed, but it would be nice to be able to pass the
publishing
on to
clear your name.
but seriously, Roy, you've never earned any money from Flowers in the Rain because of that. No, it still goes to Harold Wilson.
Not a penny, no.
More to the point, what is the Harold Wilson Trust? Where was that money going? Because surely they can't have just been putting it in their pockets. That would be...
A new roof on someone's house, maybe. Who knows?
His cottage in the Scilly Isles.
No, I mean, listen, I'm sure that there's a charity that it's meant to go to, but it's still criminal that you're having to, you had to suffer for something that Tony Secunda did.
Yeah, for publicity.
Well, I was totally not guilty, and I had all my money taken off me, which was in those days was.
And that's a big song. That's one of your biggest songs, right?
Yeah.
Flowers in the Rain for the Move.
Well, yeah, because it was the first song ever played on Radio 1.
Yeah.
So whenever there's anything going on, they always play that, you know.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
For me, Fire Brigade was so great. I loved it as a kid.
You.
And that was you singing on that one, wasn't it?
Well, actually, can I give you a little something on that? Is that, you know, Roy, I don't know if you know that Gary and I are in this band together, Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets. And we...
Brilliant.
And as our encore on the first three tours, we used to close with Point Me at the Sky. And I actually used to insert the line of Call the Fire Brigade into that.
You did, yeah. That's
from right, your song.
Really?
So, yeah, so, yeah.
Well, thank you.
There seemed to be some
more money
synonymous.
That's not coming your way.
Let's go to Harold Wilson.
You've had that, mate. Yeah, no. I think Blair got mine.
Yeah, yeah.
But a great song, you know, and just
fantastic.
I mean, production
song.
As well. I mean, that was really what was starting to come out in the Move. This kind of really ornate, cinematic style of producing that was, you know, with strange instruments here and there.
And that great thing, and parts jumping out. That's the thing I love. There'd suddenly be a guitar part just for a bar. Yeah. It's like way louder than everything else.
Well, we used to take a lot of care in those days on mixing and that kind of stuff. And I thought it would go into outer space and we'd have speakers all around the room by now, you know. But now people are listening to it on a phone in the corner of the room, just stuck on the chair, you know.
Well, at the other end, there is the whole Atmos spatial thing going on. But I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Roy, is it true, though, you that first album, the tapes all got stolen or something when you were making the first Move album?
I think so. Yeah, I didn't really know much about what was going on there. I tried to remove myself from the publicity end of it.
Because I could
get on with the writing.
To Harold Wilson, Nickham.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
What's George Brown? What's out, what's out there is that they went missing and then they got found in a skip and you had to re-record the first album again. Is this all not true?
No, we didn't re-record the album. I don't know what happened with the tapes, but they must have found them. Because we didn't re-record it.
They're wrapped around the World Cup.
Yeah, yeah. Skip. And then you're talking about Bad Fire Brigade. I went down to Olympic Studios.
In Barnes.
And we were supposed to be having a producer there mixing it, which I won't name names, but he didn't turn up. So in the end, I did it myself. I didn't get any credit on the record. But I did it myself, and that was the first time I actually got into producing properly, because me and the sound engineer had a lot in common, you know, and they worked really, really well.
Did Carl Wayne leave at the same time as Tony Secunda and Jeff Lynne arrive? Is that how it happened? Because you went from the fire into the frying pan. You ended up, got rid of Tony Secunda and got Don Arden.
Yes.
Oh, God, thank you. Thanks for reminding me. Good God. He was a disagreeable character, if anybody was. And the thing is...
Never heard that.
Yeah. And the thing is, how can I explain this? Our previous manager, who wasn't Secunda, it was somebody else, actually sold us to Arden when we were number one in the charts through Blackberry Way. So Arden never, ever had to do anything to promote us. We were already there, if you know what I mean.
Wow.
And I mean, I didn't know at the time, and I wouldn't have done it. And we were signed up and, you know, not good.
That's the story of bands in those days, wasn't it? They got sort of like treated like cattle.
Yeah, it's basically human trafficking, isn't it? I mean, it's...
Oh, say no more. Good line, I'll use that.
But when did Jeff come in, and why did Jeff come in, and how did that happen?
Well, I'd had the idea for an ELO type thing for a few years before that, and I was writing material that suited it, and the rest of the... I was in the Move at the time, and the rest of the band thought I was nuts. So...
That's right, because you'd started putting cellos and stuff on Move songs, hadn't you? You'd been trying to incorporate
that. I bought myself a... You know, I used to buy instruments, like I said before. I bought myself a cheap Chinese cello, and that worked really well on recordings, because I couldn't have called myself a good cellist, but it sounded more... I am the war, I see. Yeah. You know what I mean? A bit more scrapey than any proper cellist. And it worked great for rock and roll. Anyway, I was originally with Mike Sheridan and the Knight Riders, who changed their name to the Idle Race. And then Jeff joined them after I left, kind of thing. I knew him through that, really. And I knew he was a good songwriter. He'd been writing stuff for them. And the idea I had for ELO, I thought, well, it would be nice to have two people doing the chores rather than just me. Yeah. And I got in touch with Jeff, and
we were both Birmingham City supporters, unfortunately. We went down to a couple of games and met at the pub a few times after that and had a chat about it, you know. And Jeff was really interested in it. The only way that we could get it together was for Jeff to join the move at the end of the day. So when Carl had left, Jeff joined. He joined the move towards the end, and we did a couple of albums. And then started Jeff and I started working together more in the studio, you know, which is great. That's how the ELO thing started. Jeff came along with a sort of a skeleton idea for a song, which ended up as 105.3 AM,
which is a fantastic single.
For the single we had. So he didn't have a title for us at the time. We were working at a studio at Phonogram Studios, you know, where all the traffic is.
Because I always wondered where 105.3 AM came from. Go on.
That's how it started, yeah. We did the backing track there as the move. We were mucking about, and I'd got my cheap Chinese cello hanging about. We were playing the track back, and I started playing like Jimi Hendrix riffs, like ju-ju-ju-ju, on the cello. And Jeff said, wow, that sounds great. You know, let's record it. So I got in there and ended up putting about a dozen bloody cellos on it, playing all different things. And that was the birth of the ELO. I mean, we loved this, me and Jeff at the time. It sounded different, orchestral, but rock and roll. It sounded, you know, really great.
Just mentioned Hendrix, and of course you toured with Hendrix.
Yes, with Nick Mason.
Yeah, we did, yeah. It was, I don't know, originally a Hendrix move tour, because Hendrix had only just come into Britain and started working, you know.
What was that like what was it like first seeing Hendrix? Was it just seismic for everyone or for you?
Brilliant.
Yeah.
It was great. And it
was great.
When we did the tour with him, I mean, when he was sober, he was a really nice man. I mean, he was the one that stood up if a woman came in the room, you know. But having that American thing about him. When we were doing the tour, we played somewhere it was a coastal town down south, either Southampton or Portsmouth or one of those kind of places, in the city hall. And I went out, we'd done our sound check, and I went out to get a sandwich. And when I came back, Hendrix was doing the sound check, and they were playing I Can Hear the Grass Grow, Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Wow.
And I was going, that'll do. You know, it was absolutely great. I was knocked out, you know.
Oh, I wish there was a recording.
I went up, you know, by the side of the stage. When he came off, he said, sorry about the lyrics, man. He said, I made them up. He said, I just love the guitar riffs. You know, so that was great.
Did you tell me you tuned his guitar up, Roy? Did I forget that wrong?
Oh, yeah. A couple of times, yeah. There was our roadie, the Moves roadie, had left us, a guy called Upsey, and he was working for Hendrix when we did the tour. And this is before the days when you could get guitar tuners that you could clip onto your guitar and do all that kind of stuff. Whoever was tuning Hendrix's guitars was ill or something and wasn't there. And there was a guy, what was his name now? There's a tour manager called Jerry Stickles. And he said, oh, how can we get to tune Jimmy's guitar? And obviously said, oh, Woody will do it. He said he's got a few of his own to do. So I was happy to. And it got me out of the dressing room with the other people, you know. And I was in a little room with a tune-up amp with a few guys. It was great. I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
What was Sid Barrett like? Did you? Because Sid was on that tour, wasn't he?
I think you mentioned that when we met up before. To be fair, we used to, depending on what everybody else's gigs were, we used to go on a coach, quite a lot of us. And I don't remember Sid being on the coach, to be fair. I remember Nick Mason being on the coach, and I got quite friendly with Nick because
Well, he's a fellow Brummie, isn't he? He was actually born in... He's actually from Birmingham.
Oh, was he?
He was, yeah.
Blimey, he didn't admit to that. So anyway, I bought this jacket from, like a floral jacket from... There's a store on the King's Road in London called Granny Takes a Trip.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They used to make a lot of it.
Yeah, yeah.
They used to make a lot of stuff for the Rolling Stones and all that. So anyway, I got this jacket, which I was wearing. I was talking to Nick about it, and then I got to a gig towards the end of the tour, and he'd been and bought the trousers, the matching trousers for my jacket. So we had a good laugh about that.
You didn't take turns wearing it as a suit.
No.
So let's jump back forward where we were. So with ELO coming forward, so you actually ended up in two bands together, didn't you? Because you were both releasing records. I think the Move's last record and ELO's first.
At the same time. Well, I wanted to start ELO a lot sooner than we did. And because we'd got a contract with EMI, we still had to do, I think, two more Move albums. I thought, well, you know, I'll get Jeff involved with it. And, you know, we did the last two albums together, which was good. We had a good laugh doing that. I don't know. A lot of this has to do with Don Arden and his timing on stuff. And it, like I say, he was a bit of a disagreeable character. And a lot of things didn't happen at the time they should have happened. I mean, I'd recorded a solo album called Boulders at Abbey Road, which I played all the instruments on. And Arden wouldn't allow that to be released until 12 months later, until all this ELO thing had died down, you know, because he wanted me to reform the Move or something. I don't know. Weird.
Wow. But who came up with the name, by the way? Because it's such a perfect, does exactly what it says on the tin name.
Me.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Electric Light Orchestra. Because I was thinking, there were things on the radio at the time, with the Midland Light Orchestra, you know, just playing like light music and all that.
Yeah, the light program.
The light program. So I thought it'd be great to have a thing to do with like electric lights and all that kind of stuff, and Electric Light Orchestra. And I always wanted a really big, nice light show when we first started. Then, of course, Arden wouldn't have it, didn't want to spend the money on it. And then Pink Floyd did it, of course, and, you know, cashed in.
But you virtually had two singles out at the same time, if I remember right. As a kid, I bought both. California Man for the Move and...
California Man and 10538, yeah.
Yeah, at the same time. My God.
Both in the charts at the same time, yeah.
That's amazing. Well, you did, but Jeff sang on one and you sang on the other, right?
10538, Jeff sang on. And California Man, we both sang on.
Right.
Because I wanted to include Jeff on more stuff.
So what happened on the second album?
Because it was Arden who caused the split, wasn't it?
The split, yeah. Now, this is... I've got to be careful how I've... I don't know how you're going to edit this programme, but I've got to be careful how I say this. Because it's difficult to explain.
Do you want to do it through the medium of dance?
The reason... yeah, go on. The reason I left ELO was through pressure from Don Arden, not because, I mean, some of the media said that me and Jeff had had an argument or from now till then, I don't think Jeff had ever and I had ever fallen out. But it's how Arden and his team wanted to portray it, that we'd fallen out. So, you know, now two bands is something. And I didn't realise until years later that Arden was trying to split us up because he knew that we were both decent songwriters and he could earn more money if we were in separate bands. Think about it from a managerial point of view. So the earliest memory I have of these is Arden never came to gigs. And we were in ELO. We were doing a tour of we're over in Italy of all places, and then all of a sudden, Arden turned up with his son and a few people from the office. But I thought, what the hell's he doing here? Because he never, ever comes to gigs. He never came to any Moog gigs. Never. And I wondered, what, there's something going on here. So anyway, I mean, in those days, my hearing was good in those days. I could have got a job on a submarine, you know what I mean? I think it means very good hearing. And
great line.
We were walking down the street. We were walking down the street in Italy from the sound check, I think, to the hotel or something. And it was me and Arden side by side walking. He was chatting to me, and I was listening to what was going on behind. Jeff was behind me with a couple of people from the office. Then they were chatting, and they were spreading the shit like you wouldn't believe, saying, oh, you know, Roy wants all the publicity and this, that and the other, which is totally the opposite of what it was. You know, planting horrible stuff into Jeff's mind, if you know what I mean. And in those days, I mean, we were both only like early 20s. You know, we never thought that somebody would have a plan like this. You would now, but we didn't then. Mm. And anyway, after the tour, things started to get a bit squiffy, if you know what I mean. And rather than letting us have some time to write and relieve things for a while, he put us straight in the studio. I went in there and I just had my Fender Jazz Bass turned into a fretless. So I was really keen on playing it, like whizzing about on it and everything. And I thought, I'll try it on this
really
track.
That's really early. That's what, 70, yeah. 71 we're talking?
Yeah.
You're a pioneer there, Roy.
So I was playing stuff like Pino Palladino plays now, if you know what I mean. Not as good.
Influenced
but that
by the
kind
cello.
Of sound.
Wow.
That sort of sound. I did it on this track. That, in fact, it was a track that Jeff had written. And Jeff was being slightly grumpy about it. He says, I don't like that. Yeah, that kind of thing. But I ended up putting the fretless bass back in the case, and I walked out of the session, and I went to meet a mate of mine, Rick Price, who was the bass player in The Move, at the end of The Move, and he was the bass player in Wizard as well. Good bloke. And I just wanted somebody else's opinion who knows stuff. And he was recording at Air Studios with a band there. And we chatted about it all, and I came to the conclusion that it would be the best idea to leave ELO before we actually fell out, which we never did fall out, and that's what I did.
Right. And was Wizard straight away on your mind? How long did it take before that happened?
Well, it took us a while to get ELO together, so I didn't want to take too much time over it. And I'd already written some rock and roll tracks that I was going to put on a follow-up solo album, which I think the tracks were Ballpark Incident, See My Baby Drive, those kind of things.
Because there was a rock and roll revival at that time, wasn't there? Guy and I saw a great documentary recently about a rock and roll revival concert in America where John Lennon played.
In Toronto, which was the end of the Beatles, really. It was the first Plastic Ono Band gig. But also there was the big things at Wembley Stadium and stuff happening. Well, that was a bit later.
That was another thing that really annoyed me greatly. I was asked to do, I mean, it's a big job, the Wembley Stadium. I mean, Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis.
Oh, you did that, right.
Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bo Diddley, all them, they were all on it. This has nothing to do with Don Arden, who was still my manager at the time. But he got a bit pissed off about it. And the people that were organising it liked me, they were fans of mine. So they said, will you do it? And I said, yeah. And then I got a band together specifically to do that, which was Wizard. And Don Arden got into he put a spanner in the works somehow. And then a week before the gig, he changed the name of Wizard to The Move.
What?
On the poster.
Wow.
Oh,
think about that one.
Shenanigans.
So that could have been great publicity for Wizard at the time. Being the first, it was the first gig we ever did.
You didn't need it. I mean, you had consecutive number ones, didn't you? I mean, See My Baby Drive, Angel Fingers. I mean, but Ballpark Incident, and we're not even got to the Christmas single yet. I mean, I just remember what I loved about Wizard and why I have bought the singles was this wall of sound production, this great sort of, you know, baritone saxophones and everything going so big. And I mean, it's very Spectre-ish, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Also, one thing else,
love Spectre.
Yeah, you could tell. But going back and listening to them for this, Roy, is of remembering, is that on things like See My Baby Jive, it's just, you had an embarrassment of riches. Like there's like four separate, incredibly strong hooks in that song. You could have split that into three or four singles easily. You know, it's just hook after hook after hook. It's brilliant.
Well, what I try to do with the song is to make, rather than the middle eight section or middle bit, whichever you want to call it, just be a throwaway. I like that to be a separate entity, and let's just sort of link it up, you know, so that you can sing that. You could sing that at a football game on its own without the main song, you know. And I think that's quite important.
I just remember Ballpark Incident was such a great title. Even as a kid, I just thought, wow, what is the
Thank
incident?
You.
Yeah.
You know, and it was so
very good. What's a ballpark?
Do you know what? You had some mad stuff going on telly as well. Because what I didn't know till yesterday was that your girlfriend was Aisha Brough. And
at the time,
and she, because she was the one who used to dress
supersonic,
from Aisha's Liftoff.
Oh my God.
And she used to dance on the stage, didn't she, on Top of the Pops, dressed up as mad, you know, whatever, roller skates.
Liftoff with Aisha.
Because Liftoff with Aisha, just to say, Nick Rhodes from Duran always rubs my nose in that, because you know, for me, the first time I saw Bowie do Starman was on Top of the Pops, and he said, "Oh no." First time I saw Bowie do Starman was on Aisha.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which was before Top of the Pops. she was quite...
What can I say? Yeah.
But what a great idea that was.
Thank you. Nice to have some feedback from other... That really pleases me. That's great. Thank you. I mean, you don't have to say good things. Just say what you think. And it does help.
We are.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'll send you the check later.
But what made you want to write a Christmas song?
I said it's Harold Wilson.
What made you want to write a Christmas song, Roy?
Well, I was thinking, this is around May of that year, I think it was. And I thought, well, there hasn't been a Christmas hit for a long time, like a proper rock and roll one. They'd all been like weird comedy things, and... I think the only one I could remember at that time was Brenda Lee rocking around the Christmas tree, the original one. And I thought, time for another. And so I started writing it around about then, and like, you know, for a couple of months after that. I don't usually sit down and torture myself and write the whole song, because I'm too lazy to do that. I just write bits of it, throw them all in a folder, and then when I'm in the mood, I'll get them all out and finish it off, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, and at that time, I haven't got a clue that Slade or anybody else is going to be doing one, because I knew Noddy anyway. I mean, he's a good lad, he's Noddy, and he kept his cards close to his chest, and so did I. And so we went in to record it, Phonogram again, and I got the roadies to go in early on the session, and put two like massive fans up in the corner and some blue lights, and make it like really cold. And I phoned the band
Method.
And said, come along to the session, bring your overcoats and scarves and bobble hats. And they did. And they came along. And we actually recorded the backing tracks of that in the bloody freezing cold, and it was great. And we got into the atmosphere of it. I got the control room, you know, fairy lights and the Christmas tree and all that, you know, just to get into the thing of it. It went really, really well. And then around about 5 o'clock, I think 5:30, we all went for a break for a sandwich, and opened the doors, and it was absolutely blazing sunshine, you know, really, really put the mockers on it. This was in August we recorded it.
So I suppose I used to live near Jamie Oliver. Well, I passed by his old house where he used to live. And at about August every year, they'd be wheeling in the Christmas trees, and you'd see all the Christmas lights inside his house. Yeah. So obviously they were filming the Christmas special.
Yeah, I've still got my tree up now. Okay, there's nowhere else to put it.
This is the burning question, Roy, which does need to be answered. And I think you may have just answered it there, which is, do you wish it could be Christmas every day?
Not really.
Do you know, Guy, I read a few years ago something about some people get... there are some people out there, you know, like who go to Disneyland every day, but there are some people out there who make Christmas every day. That really exists. It's a thing.
Well,
and they make Christmas dinner for themselves every day.
Well, Barbara Mandrell, the country singer, didn't she? She was born on Christmas Day. And so in Nashville, I don't know if it's still there, but I saw it years ago. She had a Christmas shop that just sells Christmas knickknacks. All year round.
There's one
of those in Derby. Yeah. I don't know how they make a living.
Who goes in there?
Who knows?
Roy is very happy. I hope they're playing your record on the...
Yeah, exactly.
On the,
I bet they are.
Yeah, I'll check. Thanks.
It was fantastic that you got embraced into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Yeah, brilliant. And that was through ELO, in fact, really. Well, it was ELO that were doing it. And I went along to the do in New York just a few years ago, and I hadn't seen Jeff for years, and we got on absolutely fine, you know. It was great. And it was great because they actually played live for the new ELO lot, and they had some pictures on the screen at the back with me on it, which is great, which is good.
But you did, I was listening to your Annie Haslam album earlier.
Yeah.
That was a nice collaboration. How did that come about?
That was great, yeah. That was great. A couple of things that were good on that. We did a version of Going Home, Going Home, you know, the Hovis advert. And I just treated myself to some... balalaikas. I've got, because that a weird thing with balalaikas, they haven't got enough strings on to make a proper chord, so you have to have three of the bloody things and play them all together, and then it sounds like a proper chobo. And I recorded loads of them, and it sounded like a balalaika orchestra, and we did that as a backing track. I loved that.
Okay, Roy, man after your own heart, I have a bass balalaika.
Oh,
right. It's
how much do you want for it?
Yeah, I thought you were. I've had it for so long, and it's enormous. And it's like the back of it, it's like a boat, like a rowing boat, and it's like a flying V. It's got a spike in it, you have to lift it up. And
stand, oh, really?
Yeah.
Because
apparently, and there are old CBS recordings, because the Russians did have balalaika orchestras, and there were literally like 100 of them going from balalaikas that big up to my literally everything in between.
Yeah, there's loads of them. Yeah,
and they play with these really thick leather plectrums, and it's like everyone going, and it's a mad sound.
Anyone who wants a relationship with Guy has to accept that the bass balalaika comes with you, doesn't it?
Love me, love my bass balalaika.
Good, well done. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Roy, it's been absolutely fantastic having you on. You told me the other week that you've not been playing live, because you were out every single Christmas, weren't you? You and the Quo and various people, and do you miss that?
Well, strangely enough, around about the time of the pandemic happened, it was 4 years ago, something like that. I was diagnosed with diabetes 2, which is left me with a few irritations, so to speak, that are not good for touring. And so because I had the excuse not to tour anyway, because the theatres weren't doing very well at the time, to give it a miss for a while, I stopped doing it. And the only thing I miss, really, is the people. I've never really been into the travelling and all the other nonsense that goes with it, you know. But I do love the people that I work with. But since then, you know, I became friends with Alfie Bowe, who's an amazing singer. Right. And he's invited me along to a few of his gigs, so I get up and sing with him. I mean, the problem with singing with somebody like him is the first thing that crosses your mind, I need some singing lessons. Because he's bloody marvellous. He's a really good singer.
Roy, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
That's total great
honour.
Thanks, lads.
You've been in my record collection for since I first started. It's been a great honour to have you on and been able to listen to all those songs again.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Aww.
Yeah. God, he looks great, doesn't he? He does look good. 70
something. Quite imposing. He had those two stained glass windows behind him.
Crusaders type shields.
Yeah, and he's got a bit of that look about him.
It's so much though, isn't there?
Man
so
of Albion.
But seriously, the Move and ELO and Wizard and just, you know, gave a lot to music, has given a lot. Still is, probably.
Would recommend to all of this because it's been a great deep dive because those Move records are fantastic, especially. And that first ELO album. And again, the Wizard stuff is it's like an embarrassment of pop riches.
Well, on that first ELO album, oh, there's my dog.
Well, your dog's on the first ELO album.
Get out. He's just gone down to attack an Amazon man. But on that first ELO album, there's that fantastic proggy sort of medieval song, isn't there? Yeah. The Battle of Marston Moor. Oh, hang on. My dog's really howling. I'm going to have to go.
All right. Well, there it is. Sounds like Seamus. So thanks to Ben, our producer. Thank you to Roy for being brilliant.
Yeah. And we'll see you next week. You'll hear from us next week. Anyway, it's good night from me.
Or Gary's dog, and it's good night from them.
Rockanteurs is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.